So I wanted to start by picking up with one piece of the Mishnah that we were learning last time. Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, beloved of human being who was created in the image of God. We spent, if you'll recall, a fair bit of time on that Mishnah, in particular, sort of exploring the question of what's the relationship between the notion that the human being is loved by dint of being B'Tzelem Elohim, on the one hand, and the notion of the human being even more loved by dint of the fact that we are told that. Before we leave that Mishnah behind, I wanted to take a minute to juxtapose it. If you have the packets from last time, I wanted to juxtapose it for a minute, as some classical commentaries on the Mishnah do, with Avot Perek Gimel Mishnah Aleph, Avot 3:1. The Rabbi Akiva Mishnah that we saw is Avot 3:14, but the first Mishnah of that chapter is very famous also, and in some way less appetizing. And I want to just for a minute read it, and then think for a second about the relationship between these two Mishnayot, because I think actually that we'll see that these two Mishnayot represent two models of what we'll flesh out in a minute, okay? Akavya bin Mahalal El Omer, people with me, it's page 4 in last week's packets where it says source B. If anyone needs copies of last week's packet, you can have them with Shana's notes appended, because the printer broke as I was making more copies of various things this morning. There, it's over there. Now we're done. Akavya bin Mahalal El Omer. So this figure Akavya says, Histakel b'shloshad varim v'iya tabali de avera. Look at three things, examine three things, and you will not succumb to the power of sin. Dame ayin bata, know from where you came, ula'ana taholech, and to where you are headed, v'lifnei miyata umed, and before whom you are standing. Okay, sounds great. What's the matter? Sorry, thank you. This is what happens when you're half on an airplane. Sorry. Right? Who are you going to be accountable to in the world to come? So then he adds, in case you want to have a kind of dramatic image, Me'ayin bata metipas rucha. Where do you come? From a dirty, filthy drop. Where are you going? You're going to a place filled with worms and maggots and dust. And before whom you are in the future going to be judged, the King of the Kings of Kings, the Blessed Holy One. Okay, now, Akavya's Mishnah, right, is a very well-known example of how do you steer a human being towards the right path? You basically say, you're nothing. You're totally nothing. Get over yourself. And not only are you nothing, but compare yourself to God, who is perfect, transcendent, in some way immutable, at least in relation to the things that are going to future consume in the future consume you, right? And you can't possibly, because you're, who are you? Who do you think you are? You're nothing, right? Now there was a time, one second, there was a time, and there are all kinds of moments in the history of Jewish thought and spirituality that sort of dilate on, emphasize this mode of trying to elicit tshuva and repentance. You have this model, for example, in the more radical schools of the Musar movement, right? Who do you you're not even worth. You're garbage. Especially compared to God. Now, the reason I wanted to read this Mishnah, now that we've read Rabbi Akiva's Mishnah, which you'll recall begins with Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, Chiba Yitera Nodaklo Shenivra B'Tzelem, right? Beloved is the human being, even more beloved is the human being, is that I want to just propose to you that in this third chapter of Pirkei Avot, we'll call them, right, the Akiva Akavya dichotomy, are really two models for, first of all, to say this in philosophies for a second, two models of theological anthropology, right, that is a theological vision of what it means to be a person, but more sort of simply, two models for what it means to motivate, elicit, imagine a relationship between a mortal human being and the transcendent God, right? Akavya is sort of about going from a place of nothingness, and Akiva is from a place of belovedness and relationality. Meaning, I think that the temper, the tone of the two statements are really interesting models for how we might sort of imagine what it means to think of ourselves and each other in relationship to God and in relationship to what it is about us that makes it possible for us to live in relationship with God. Or maybe a better way of putting it, Akavya is not really that interested in relationship in this one, right? It's like, don't do the bad. Don't let evil take hold of you. And Akiva's like, no, it's actually all about love. I mean, they're really like, in many crucial ways, 180 degrees apart. Now, I want to take any sort of comments about that, thoughts about that, just for a couple seconds, and then I want to do something maybe a little counterintuitive. Leah, you wanted to say something, but I don't know if you...
I just wanted to say, when I read this last week, looking at like almost forgotten here about Islam, it's like it was all the piece, all the three pieces didn't seem to be like realistic. But I think that's a copyist message. But it's funny because like if you really like we're nothing, why is the Supreme King of Kings judging? Like maybe I think they're more alike than they seem to be. I mean, he's talking about gratitude, and so I'm not thinking that it's a more obvious person than it is. But it's like
so
if that's a drop, then there's no reason to be.
Your reading, which I think is really interesting, your reading would have Akavya's Mishnah be a reprise, consciously or not, of Psalm 8. Right? Psalm 8, which we have time, maybe we'll look at later. Psalm 8 is the famous Ma'adam Batei Da'ehu. Right? What is a human being? And then moves to Vatichasreo Me'at Me'Elohim. Right? Or, you know what? Even forget that you only made him a little less than God. But even forget that for a second. Think about the experience of the psalmist in Psalm 8 that says, Ma'adam, that's one pole, Vateda'ehu. Meaning, because the first part of the verse is, what is a human being? What? And yet, Vateda'ehu, and yet, he is known to you. Right, even that formulation is a kind of dialectic, right? Because if you really meant without kind of counterweight, ma'adam, of course God wouldn't know you. God would brush you off. So if you're right, Leah, right, he might be playing with precisely that. And if we don't get to this, if we don't get to this today, which we might not, take a look. Here's a little sort of interesting thing to spend independent Beit Midrash time on for a few minutes. Compare Psalm 8's use of the words Ma'adam Batedaehu and Psalm 144's use of Ma'adam Batedaehu. And then if you want to really have a good time, read Job chapter 7 at the same time. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't think
number three here is meant to be more hopeful or like imbue you with more significance?
I don't either, but I'm trying to support Leah's reading as best I can.
Right. Okay. Well, I think the gist of this is like, yeah, you're very insignificant. You're like pretty much nothing, and you're in big trouble.
Yes. By the way, exactly. Avi, that's great. That's actually one of the reasons why I sort of think Leah's reading is not ultimately so convincing, because if you think about the models, what is the fundamental statement about God's relationship with you in each of the two Mishnayot? Right? One of them is, oh boy, fasten your seatbelt. And the other is, God loves you.
I guess all it is I think you're right. I think that is the point. It's like, you're really, really small and you're in trouble. But I think the very fact that, like, Melech Elohim is going to tell you that you're in trouble, you can't get away from the bigger theology that's just behind. You know what I mean? Like, you can't get away from the theology enough to say, like, you actually just a behemoth, you know, and you're not going to actually be judged. Right.
Yeah, so the question is it better or worse? I mean, what if it was just parts one and two from where you came and where you're going? And it's like, you're there, you're nothing, then you're gone, you're nothing.
Yeah.
Right, but like, I feel like there's a certain kind of dread in number three that, like, sort of imagines that numbers one and two on their own would be like, all right, like, at least nothing, you know, nothing happens.
Okay, so Avi,
worse.
But it's like, against your, you know, this is later on in Pirkei Avot, against your will you're born, against your will you're done,
yeah.
Against your will you'll be judged.
So Avi, here's what I would say to you in sort of defense of, or in my own twist on Leah's reading. Even if you're right, as I think you are, I think Leah's point is different, which is there's something potentially self-subverting about saying, oh, and you know what else is bad? One day you're going to have to give an accounting to the judge who created the universe and is ruler of all. And I think Leah's point is, you know what? Just saying that means you're not utterly insignificant. Right? It's a kind of, you undo yourself with that argument. When you say, you're so nothing that one day God's going to pay attention to every last thing you did, you have actually undermined, arguably, right?
That's the whole thing. It's not really a statement on human nature, whether we're good or bad. It's a statement on significance, on life significance. And saying, like, oh, you may think from one and two that you're really nothing, and you came from nothing, you're going back to dust. But actually, your every single thing that you do is incredibly significant and going to be judged by the people. Like, it's scary.
Okay.
It's not significant, but it's significant.
So if we created a spectrum of readings with Avi and Leah on one side, you're a lot closer to Leah, and maybe even actually beyond Leah in a certain way. And that's not the only reading that's possible. Fine, fair enough. So if you guys are right, then the dichotomy Akiva and Akavia, despite its, you know, literary cuteness, sort of gets less strong. But I do think, let's put it this way, the tenor is actually very important. So much so that, here's what I want to ask for a minute, okay? And this is something I want us to think about. It is so sort of like self-explanatory for American Jews living modernity, post-modernity, whatever we want to describe ourselves in, right? In an ethos of modernity valuing the human being so much, we all want to, like, say some version of Akiva's Mishnah is great. It's the basis of an awful lot of theological thinking in Akavi, you know, whatever. We have a tradition, has many sources, is what we'd like to kind of make it, right? And so I want to ask us to do something really crucial here. Tell me why Akavia's Mishnah is, could be, or even should be important to building a Jewish theology or spirituality. By the way, this is not a position of my endorsing it. I just want us to sort of think sort of expansively for a second. What would be the place of this Mishnah in your building a contemporary kind of theory of what it means to be a person in relationship with God? Is there one?
I think there's a lot of humility that can come from that type of approach. I think there's also a lot of interpersonal stuff that that kind of approach can affect, in that if I am nothing compared to God, so is the person next to me, and there's like sort of this communal understanding that between people are also, you know, an ability to say I'm not so much greater than anyone else. And I think lastly, which might be the most obvious thing, which is who am I to change anything about this tradition that I have? I just kind of, the idea of like being born into a certain tradition and being subservient to it to a certain extent.
Is this you talking, by the way, or is this you trying to imagine how one might talk about it?
Me trying to imagine how one might talk
about it. So are any of the things you just said you talking? Because I'm interested right now in someone sort of stepping up, even if it's tentatively.
Not anymore.
Okay. So let me caveat this. Wait, this is actually important. I'm interested in someone who can do the following for me. Make a case, even if it's tentative, even if it's tenuous, for why this mission is important, without it being just a mask for turning whatever self-loathing I struggle with into a theology. Maybe you'll say, no, but that's what this is. I'm asking whether that has to be the case. Okay? So there, Rebecca, Vicky.
It suggests something surprising, which is that humility, or the lack of humility, is the source for sin. And that is like very directly. So it sort of suggests what the root of sin is, which is not something that I would have ever imagined the root of sin to be. So if you have humility, like Shoshi's talking about, then that is what brings you away from sin rather than other things we might imagine.
So that reading is, in a way, when you talk about arrogance, is that the word you used?
I used the word lack of humility.
Yeah, so if you remember the talk I gave about Heschel and Tefillah a few months ago about self-assertion as his sort of kind of paradigm sinful behavior or mode of being, there's something, what you're saying is actually close to that. Although Heschel would never have sort of embraced this Mishnah on its own as a way of thinking about what a human being is. Vicky?
I mean, you talk about it in, you're asking the question, contemporary theology, I see this as being anti-narcissistic, which this society is, anti-materialistic, and anti-competitive.
Okay, great.
And in that way, I would see it as having a place in contemporary theology.
Okay. Yeah, Alex, take a couple more.
Yeah, I like that, Steve.
Great.
And I guess it's kind of a question and kind of a proposed reading, but like, what is the understanding of like what happens after death in this mission? Is it you rot in the dirt, or is it you go to like be judged? And that if the emphasis is like you have your life and it begins in one way, it ends in one way, and like the Atid Lavo thing, like that's sort of off to the side, like that it can be read to place certain emphasis on like this life and the importance of this life, and that like the important thing isn't where you came from, where you're going, but like how you live in the moment. But I don't really know how to fit that in with the last part, but like,
yeah, I think it's actually interesting. You know, implicit in what you said is a kind of another discussion we could have at some point about, you know, how Chazal imagine, if you can say that Chazal as a whole imagine in one way, right, which I'm not sure you could say that about most things, what happens after you die. Seemingly the description is, you know, your body turns to rot and then something in you is accountable, which might call into some need for further elaboration our discussion about Chazal in the college week, having an almost monistic conception of the self. Right? Meaning if there's some part of you that's rotting in the earth, another part of you that's appearing in court, right? There's stuff to think about there. There were other hands up. Benji, and then Jordan, and then, yeah, maybe we'll push forward. I'm sorry. Just because
I think it needs to focus on Torah. Like, if there is this unbridgeable gap between the King of Kings and my filthy physicality, then the one thing that bridges that is this gift of Torah, this thing that brings the spiritual to the very physical world. And I think, in a way, it can be a lot less complacent than a theology that says, by the very virtue of my being, I am in the image of God and close to God. But rather, I'm miles away from God, and all I can do is work really, really hard to try and bring any spirituality into my human world.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Any who did I say? Did I already around Jordan? Sorry.
Yeah. I would like focus, or I guess, on the words, but yathabali de avirah, and to do that as right, like the passive, right? You're avoiding avirah, whereas kavi vadamshin shim rabitzelam would be the active, maybe, and bring you to like chayim shalitzah.
Great. Okay. Interesting. All right. I know there's more hands up. Maybe we'll get a chance to hear some of them coming up. I want to just sort of maybe rephrase some of what people said, which I think is interesting and really worth thinking about in some really basic ways, right? Which is, if we take the language of Rabbi Akiva's Mishnah of Chaviv Adam seriously, in the context of what we talked about when we said last time what it means to say Chayav kol echad ve'echad lomar bishvili nivra olam, everyone has to say for my sake was the world created. That is, if we take the statement of being loved as entangled with a sense of obligation and calledness, that's great. But in a cultural context where the state of being loved is just the state of being loved and makes no demands and has no expectations, then a caveat comes in as a kind of interesting counterweight, right? Because the sentence, I am loved by God, or God loves you, can have a lot of different and therefores to it, right? It can have, therefore you're summoned to live in a particular way. It can have, therefore there's the possibility of forgiveness no matter how far off you fall. But it can also have, therefore enjoy yourself. After all, God picked you to be in the wealthiest neighborhood in the history of the world. And God loves you. You know, what do you have to worry about? You don't, there's no obligations here. It's like great. And if that's the temptation, which I think different people in this room have sort of suggested, Vicky's invocation of narcissism, Alex's embrace of Vicky's formulation, right? If that's the danger, then a caveat is sort of an interesting counterweight, right? Yeah, but you're also nothing. And I actually want to suggest that consciously or not, the tradition that develops in Chassidut of living simultaneously with the, you know, the opposite claims, right? Bishvili nivra ha'olam and anochi afar va'efer, right? For my sake was the world created and I am but dust and ashes. Right, is in a way a meditation on holding these two Mishnayot together at the same time. I don't know if that's conscious, right? But is it clear what I mean by that? Right. In other words, right, that Akavya and Rabbi Akiva are really just the two poles, and this is where, you know, those of you who have studied with me before, right, you know, this is kind of like a broken record of mine, but, you know, usually Jewish theology, when presented with an either-or question, will end up saying yes, both. And I think that this is a really interesting example of that, where Jewish theology says both. You know what you are? You are totally nothing and worthless. And you know what else you are? Infinitely valuable, and no one before and no one ever again will ever be just like you, and that is a statement of the glory of God. And they're both true. And that's what happens when you read these two Mishnayot together at the same time. I at least want to sort of suggest. Okay. Alan, you look like you're in physical pain as a result of what I just said. No? Oh, okay. Existential pain? No?
No, I'm just
tired?
Putting things together.
Oh, okay, great. Don't let me interrupt. Great. Okay. You actually now have it in two packets, but because I was untrusting, I didn't know how many people would have their packet. I'm going to give you another packet. I want to spend a few minutes looking at something that is easy to sort of poo-poo, but I want to sort of contend is is or should be a kind of fundamental spiritual and interpersonal practice. And then we're going to try something with this. Okay? So, if you look at what it says, Selam Elohim Part 2, right, to the beginning of the packet, the first source is one that we saw at the end of the session on embodiedness in the Winter Learning Seminar. And I just want to present it here as a frame for thinking about what we're about to read. Okay? So, Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, B'sha'ah she'adam holech baderech, when a person walks on her way, Ikonyasha malachim mahalchim lefanav, umachrizin ve'omrin, tnu makom le'ikonyasha l'kadosh baruch hu. When a person is walking on the way, a kind of procession of angels walks before her and announces, make way for the icon of God. And remember, right, I hope I don't have to remind you of this, but remember, an icon in rabbinic literature means, right, as it means in the rest of the ancient world, not just a representation, but a representation in which the represented is also contained. Right? So the human being is not just a representation of God, but in some way, which we talked about at great length, the presence of God is contained therefore, therein. There is no chachut, there is divine presence. Right? Okay, we'll leave the proof text for now. So, I want to ask what for now is a rhetorical question, and then later I want to ask it as an actual question, which is, what would happen to me in my life if I actually imagined this? If I spent 72 hours committed to the notion that every human being that passed me was accompanied by a procession of angels that said, make way for an icon of God. How would my conduct, emotional response, kind of posture towards the human change, the human in front of me, I mean? It's also the reason why I always find this text so interesting. Is that this is a really good example of something else we talked about during the Winter Learning Seminar, which is it really does collapse any attempt to build a strong wall between Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and Bein Adam L'Makom. Right? It collapses any attempt, that is, to build a wall between mitzvot that are about your relationship to God and mitzvot that are about your relationship to other people, because actually that's what I meant by saying that it's both a spiritual and an interpersonal practice. Because you're actually, right, the whole point is the way you interact with another person is a way you interact with God. And then ideally also the opposite. But okay. Now, in light of that, I wanted to just share with you two Mishnayot that I think are really interesting and very easy to overlook, especially since the more... Well, you know what? I'll bracket that. Shammai Omer... Asei Toratcha Keva, Emor Me'at Ve'asei Harbe, Ve'havei Mekabelet Kol Ha'adam B'Sefer Panim Yafot. Now, as with many Mishnayot in Avot, we could spend time exploring whether and to what extent the three are connected to each other, the three things that a person says. I don't want to do that now, but I just want to sort of focus on his third statement, Hevei Mekabelet Kol Ha'adam B'Sefer Panim Yafot. Right, and the English, I have no idea how to really render that. You know, cheerful countenance is very common in Mishnah translations as a way of rendering this. The problem with cheerful countenance is that it seems so like, you know, cheerful countenance is if you get a job as like, you know, serving coffee at Starbucks, your boss says, have a cheerful countenance, or I mean, they don't really say that, but you know, it sounds so surface, and maybe I'll remind you here, and I don't know if this is a midrash or not, but Shlomo Carlebach used to say that if you want a lesson in Jewish ethics, you should remember that the word for inside and face are the same. right? The word for face, panim, is the same root as the word panim, one's inwardness. And so I want to actually just sort of suggest, sefer panim yafot is not cheerful countenance as in, you know, standing behind the counter and I smile because I might get a bigger tip. I don't want to interest clear. And also not trying to impugn the motives of people starving. Okay? I just want to make sure. It seems to me, here's the point I'm trying to make clumsily, that sefer panim yafot is a kind of human posture, not, you know, a way of making myself look. And the emphasis here is Heve mekabel et kol ha'adam b'sefer panim yafot, right? Every human being. And then, less well known, right, is Rabbi Yishmael, Heve kal larosh v'noach l'tishchoret v'heve mekabel et kol ha'adam b'simcha. And receive every human being with joy. And that too, right, I want to sort of just underline, is not, you know, surface happiness. It's actually sort of, right, the true joy of welcoming another. Yeah, Ellie, you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of alternative ways to translate et cetera tcha keva in relation to the rest of it. Would it make sense to think of it not just as study of Torah, but engagement or practice of Torah? It's a posture outward. It's not just the study, but what you're doing.
So I am tempted by that reading too. The way to answer that question is very hard and very easy. It's very easy in that what you have to do is simply look at a huge number. Every single of you were writing, you know, a scholarly article, but at least a large number of places where the word Torah is used in Tanaitic literature, and see whether it ever means one's living out of Torah in the world as opposed to one's learning. I would love you to be right, because I think it makes this mission, the three, become amazingly powerful. I say Torah Tcha Keva, right? You know, make it fixed, not something you do once in a while. And more Ma'at V'Haseh Arbe, it's not about, you know, saying wonderful things, it's about the day-to-day, right? Don't make huge promises and then not deliver them. Actually make small promises and then deliver big things, right? And here's a way to begin, really. Or here's a way that's overarching. Yeah, so I think that would be great, but that's the research we would need to do. This is taken, we're just going to read a couple more things and then we're going to stop for a second, okay? This is taken in some really interesting ways, in two sort of somewhere between halachic and rhetorical statements. First of all, this very interesting elaboration on Shammai's statement in Avot Rabbi Natan, Heve mekabel et kol ha'adam b'sefer panim yafot, ketzad. How is that? Melamed she'im natan adam lechavero kol matanot tovot sheba olam ufanav kushim ba'aretz ma'ale alav katuv ki ilu lo natan lo klum. Right? You can give your friend, the English on the next page, you can give your fellow every last material gift in the world, but if you do it and your face is sort of forlorn and downcast, it's as if all of those things that you gave your fellow were completely worthless. Aval hamekabel et chaverot b'sefer panim yafot, afilu lo natan lo klum, ma'ale alav hakatuv ki ilu natan lo kol matanot tovot sheba olam. But if, on the other hand, you give them nothing, by the way, I want to make it clear, this does not mean that, oh, you know what, I don't actually give tzedakah, I just smile. I think this actually means, as many commentaries point out, if you actually have limit in what you're able to give or do, right, there's actually no limit in your capacity to be gracious. And the argument of this passage about Rabbi Natan is, right, again, obviously stated somewhat rhetorically, but the point is actually still important, that how you give is actually at least as important as whether. And according to this formulation, at least, more so. By the way, one of the ways in which I think this Mishnah is actually very important, there are many ways, but I want to just sort of suggest one for a second. You know, I think there are a lot of questions in terms of ethics and halakha about giving money to people on the street. There are a lot of really interesting questions, or I think there are a lot of very compelling arguments for why you absolutely have to. There's a lot of, I think, compelling arguments for why you wouldn't. I think there's very good arguments for why, if you've seen someone drunk, it may be forbidden to give them money, right? It's a classic example of lifnei iver lo titen michshol, right? Now, that doesn't mean you are patur from helping them. It means you have to think in more complex ways about what it means to help the homeless, right? But here's one thing that I think is almost never excusable unless you have reason to fear for your physical safety, and I think this is actually different for men and for women at least some of the time, right? If someone who was dressed like you said something to you, you would likely answer them. It would be inconceivable to you to just keep walking. It would actually be inconceivable to you. And yet somehow, right, it's a New York way of living, right? No smile, no response, no nothing. And that, I think, you know, this Avot Rabbi Natan is in a way directly about that. It's directly about that. It's hard, by the way. I mean, I don't know if this has changed, I think. But when we were growing up, we were always told, you know, when you're walking in New York, just whatever you do, don't make eye contact. Right? And that struck me as well. In other words, New York is a great place to have no spiritual life. Right? No, seriously, right? We never make eye. What happens to you if you never make eye contact? I mean, what does that do to your relationship to human beings, to your relationship to the notion that human beings matter, to your relationship that one of the most important places your relationship with God plays out is in your basic interaction? What happens? So, I want to suggest that. And by the way, I don't have an answer to this question. I really don't have an answer to this question. But to the question of, you know, is it of giving money to the poor on Shabbat and the kind of difficulty of halakhically not being able to do that, there are things you could still give to someone. And it's true, by the way, it is true that some people, I have no doubt about this, will regard your stopping to smile as, you know, potentially dripping with condescension. But in my experience, that is actually very rarely true. Actually, you know, here, just to sort of share something from my own life, I actually remember something that really, like, helped me understand this mission a little bit was once when I was living in Cambridge. It was Friday night, and unlike homeless people in Manhattan, homeless people in Cambridge don't know Hilchot Shabbat. So he asked me for money, and I said, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not carrying a wallet. He said, thank you. And then I kept walking. Like, after I'd walked like four steps, he said, thank you for answering me. And I thought that was like enormously powerful, like, about this. And not that I, you know, I'm holding myself up as a paradigm of this, but I think it's really interesting to sort of think about this. Okay, now, one last source, and then, okay. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, here I'm in the Gemara, Masechet Ketubot. I'm not going to play, it's a great pun on a pasuk, which I'm not going to look at here. And this is going to sound like it's a great line, but I actually want to suggest that it's actually a very profound and interesting statement. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Tov hamalbin shinayim lechaviro yoter mimashkehu chalav. It is better to malbin shinayim, to really show the whiteness of your teeth to someone, than to give them milk to drink. And, you know, if you go later on and you play with the pasuk, you'll figure out what the midrash is. But actually, I sort of want to suggest that Rabbi Yochanan's statement is actually a declaration about the significance, the consistently and completely underestimated significance of sort of countenance in interpersonal relations. Or put that differently, right? That smiling is, receiving a smile is often more important than receiving basic foodstuffs, basic food needs. That's actually what he's saying, right? If milk is sort of the kind of standard biblical rabbinic image of like the stuff that is nutrition that makes us function and thrive, the claim is, yeah, next to a smile is nothing. Now, so you might think, you might be thinking, some of you might be thinking, right? I can't believe that in a series of shiurim on, like, you know, Jewish ideas to change your life, part of Judaism. We've just spent 20 minutes talking about smiling. Well, if that's what you've been thinking, you've been living in New York too long. I'm actually being totally serious. Meaning, I think this is a consistent way that Chazal imagined what it means to take Tzel and Elohim seriously. And remembering that what I said before, I meant like very seriously, which is that the smiling piece is not surface. Or think of it this way, right? Remember, I keep coming back to this, right? Sefer HaChinuch, in talking about the Korban Pesach, Mitzvah Tet Zayin says, right, that the most powerful way of changing your inner life is by doing external actions. So what happens to your inner life if you're totally committed to greeting every human being? What do you think? Let's ask this. Can it be done much more dramatically than 99% of the people living here do?
It could, but it's still a process. I mean, how many people would look at in the eye? How many people look could be do that too? And then if we're doing that with all our attention going, it's two like these external faces that we see in passing moments. And then our attention never can do it. Other things that could be more concentration.
Okay, so how do you think that these Shammai and Rabbi Yishmael, two fairly thoughtful people, would respond to that? I mean, right, one option is to say, well, they would live in a community with 40 people. It might be. But, yeah, do you want to say something about Leah? And someone else had their hand up, too. Abby and Emma.
I think that it's more, I think they would say, this is a posture toward the world, which is something that you often say as a phrase, but I think it's helpful. It's not like literally, I don't get this literally to mean like we walk out on the sidewalk and greet everybody with a smile and talk to them. It's not only unfeasible, but I don't think everybody would welcome. That's not what it's saying. Like, they don't need to be respected by somebody who isn't even interacting with them, necessarily. I think it's like, I think about this a lot with things like American Jewish World Service, where they send all these people to the place where they're giving their grants, and it's like, these people don't know what the heck they're doing, including myself. Why are they going? I think I went because I was supposed to do this with people, just to sit with people, and that it's like a posture. Like, what I did a lot of in Southern Bell was just smile at people. I couldn't speak to them. I just smiled at them a lot, and they smiled at me, but it was very real, because like we come together for a good reason. And I think that that's, especially the Yochanan, the milk versus the smiley thing, is there, they definitely meet milk in that literal sense, but the posture of actually coming there and not condescending as well is very, very important. That you don't. That's not what tzedakah is about.
Yeah, you know, Leah, the same thing you just said, in a way, you could, I mean, not quite, but you could, without too much difficulty, transfer to what we all do Wednesday afternoons. Right? I mean, that is, what does it mean to spend time with people who the only, actually, interpersonal exchange you're really capable of having is holding a hand or smiling? What is that about? And what's the argument of this Mishnah about that? About, you know, for those who are, this is not meant as a criticism of anyone in particular, so stuck in their heads that unless you can have an intellectual exchange, you feel like you're not actually having a human exchange. Right? Rabbi Yochanan is here to explode that. Abby?
It seems to me that all these rabbis are basically saying, this is not in human nature to do this, to act this way, and to be this way, and to interact this way. So we have to lay out, enumerate, very specifically, as small as a smile. It just strikes me that basically we're asking you to do the hard thing, which is actually not going to come naturally to you if we don't explain it and lay it out, which is, to me, kind of just deflating about who we are. We need these things spelled out this much, or we're not going to smile with someone, or we're not going to sit with someone, or we're not going to... And so I'm just wondering, is there just a sense that we are not starting from any of this as an instinct, as an impulse?
So I think that many Jewish thinkers slash sort of canonical sources would say, it's not that we don't have this as an instinct, it's that we have this and its opposite as instincts. This and its opposite. Right? Right? In other words, we have the instinct to be cruel, and we have the instinct to be kind. That's a maybe just a simplistic way of saying a Yitzhak, or maybe an unsimplistic way of saying a Yitzhak Hara and a Yitzhak Hatov. Right? We have, or maybe better than instincts, impulse. I'm a little nervous about like getting into the question of instincts, but fine, we believe there's actually, many scientists believe there is a kind of compassion instinct. I think the issue is not that we don't have this, it's that we don't, two things, right? We also have the opposite, and we don't do a good job of cultivating and keeping this alive. And I think that actually goes very directly to Leah's point. It's almost the equivalent of ritual, right? You know, how do you keep something alive? By regularizing it. There were Alan, no? Shana, and then Rachie, and then we'll move on. Alana, did you have, because, okay, I keep thinking, sorry.
I just wanted to say about the smiling versus giving milk, because, like, I understand the idea that it's presenting in terms of, like, showing kindness to an individual and, like, that being really important, but I'm just wondering also, like, how someone would feel who really needed that milk, and, like, the danger of reading it in terms of, well, I smiled at them, or like I said hello, and like that was kind and that was generous, versus,
right,
like there are people in our world who like really are in like tremendous need for kindness and for actual things. So I'm just wondering if like there are other sources or just ideas about, like, I think like both are what's really important, and it seems to be just stressing,
right,
one.
So I want to say two quick things in response to that, even though I think it's an important issue to put on the table, and Leah sort of already put a version of that in a way on the table. First of all, I'm not sure that a statement like this should ever be taken as, here's a rule for life that applies literally in every situation, so much as, here's a reorientation of the way you conventionally think about what matters and what doesn't. Right? Once you see it that way, something different happens. Because of course if someone's starving, you're not going to be like, oh, good to see you. Bye. Right? Because, now, that leads to the second thing I want to say. If you take this smiling thing in the way that I'm suggesting, as a posture rather than a way of making your face, how would you smile at someone and let them go hungry? What would that mean? That would mean that your smile was on some level a lie. See, what I'm suggesting is, and I'm suggesting it, there's nothing I feel that I can sort of defend either philosophically or psychologically yet, but I'm actually suggesting that this is an interesting way to reorient in general in ways that have really profound and basic consequences for how I imagine my relationship to the world more broadly. Right? In other words, I don't believe you can take Sefer Panim Yafot seriously as a practice and have it be, oh, from now on I just do Sefer Panim Yafot. I think it's a fundamental reimagining of what it means to encounter other humans. And that has limitless consequences. That's, for me personally, Shana, that's why this is so important, right, as an aspiration. Because if you take Sefer Panim Yafot seriously, you can never live the same way again. I totally believe. I mean, you just can't. Rachie, excuse me?
Go back to the conversation of whether or not this is instinctual. I think the way that I sort of see this is, like, rather than using the language of instinct, I'm thinking more about, like, intuition and how when you, like, so, okay, you're not going to be able to walk a New York City block or from like here to the train station and like have these moments of smiling connection with every single person that walks by. But like that's not really all that necessary. What's necessary is that the one person, or what's like relevant, is that the one guy who sits like in front of Mo's every night, that like when we walk by, I'm sure many people have this like thought in their head of like, do I do something? Do I not do something? Maybe like afterwards there's some sort of regret, or like maybe just like getting it out of your head really quickly. I don't think it's about like every having this interaction with every person, but like knowing that there are certain interactions that actually this is way more applicable to, and that the fact that it's saying like the simplicity of the language here, like just saying smiling or greet every human being with joy. It's not like this prescriptive list of like things that you do. It's like there's something inside of you that knows that this is an option, and maybe we're trying to like compel people to take that option, to really like act on the intuition, as opposed to like it's not instinctual, right. It's not, but the thought is there, and maybe this is also like the reorientation is to react to the intuition and to create action based on like the thoughts that came out of that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. This is, I think what you said is beautiful, Richie. And here's the thing that like personally I wrestle with a lot. On the one hand, I'm sort of totally sympathetic to the notion that there is an instinct, even if there are also competing instincts. On the other hand, the thing that strikes me a lot is that in many ways, it would be a lot easier to do all the conventional trappings of religion, every last detail of them. It's a lot easier in some ways to do that than to do this. I actually really think that's true. Meaning, which is why, it's one of the reasons why I try to spend so much of my life talking about religion being about doing this kind of thing. Because in some ways, to be honest, it's easier not to do Borer on Shabbat than it is to have Sefer Panim Yafot with some stranger, to be honest, I don't have the time of day for, literally or metaphorically. By the way, in no way do I mean to like to say something pejorative or dismissive about how hard it is to have other forms of spiritual discipline as well. But I think it's so complicated, right? It's on the one hand, it's so obvious and intuitive. On the other hand, it's so totally difficult. And I just think that that's like worth not just thinking about, but really sort of sitting with what that would mean. Ross, you wanted to say something before, and I didn't. She hadn't been, but I'll call on her first.
Oh.
But yeah, go for it.
I guess I'm just curious in this interaction how the other pole of like you are dust and you are nothing plays into it. Like it's easy to say like I am dust and I am nothing, so I'm going to be humble. And you are Zelen Elohim, so I'm going to elevate you.
Right.
But then how do we interact with people saying, like, I'm not important, or I am, what can I give to you, you who only God can raise up? Like, what does that do for our interactions, or how can we have both of these in our interactions with other people?
Right, so if I understood you correctly, you just said something I think is really interesting, and it's one of the complicating factors of Akavia's Mishnah potentially, not necessarily, but potentially, which is, if the logic of Tzelem Elohim is such that if I see myself as a Tzelem Elohim, and infinitely valuable, and loved by God, and for my sake was the world created, then I have to see everyone else that way, then is the logic of Akavia's Mishnah, hey folks, I ain't the only worm in this room. And what are the consequences of that? Now, Shoshi pointed us to one of the ways in which we might be able to sort of say, well, wait a second, right? What consequences is no ego. There's no competitiveness. Actually, and you said that too, Vicky, I think. Right? So there is, and that's why I said potentially, not necessarily. But there is a potentially really problematic conclusion, right? I'm a shmata, and so are you, right? And ultimately, that doesn't lead to ethics. It leads to some, I don't know what exactly. You want to respond to that, right?
Yeah. It seems like to some extent we're holding the relationship between people and people and people and God as the same.
No, as interwoven. Never ever the same.
The same.
I don't think they're the same.
I guess, right connected. And on the other hand, there's this tendency I think we're going to of there are different rules between people and people. Because even though the way you take I am dust and relate that to people is very different than the way you relate that to God. So it's sort of hard to say.
Right, great. Fair enough. I think that's a really interesting response, and that might be what Akavya said, which is you have no right to say that when it comes to another person.
We're all on the same plane, humans.
Right.
So we have sort of a different set of...
Right. No, that's interesting. That's interesting. Okay. I'm sorry, Ross. I have to.
I feel like, so this question about like how we can smile at people, that sort of like seems to me relates to very specific communities and spaces and like what that would mean to translate into like how to be kind to someone, stranger, or neighbor is a little different than like, the community people felt like.
Okay.
And like, I'm not a New Yorker, I think at all, and being here is a very strange thing in certain ways because I feel like I end up relating to people mostly as though like, I'm really kind of like kebab and calm. Like, oh, as long as I don't, like, leave my God and no trip, like, we're on fine terms. But, like, that's the extent of our dynamic, and that's also the extent of, like, my ethical thinking in terms of how I relate to people. So, like, in terms of, like, really internalizing some kind of posture about smiling at someone, I'm curious, like, just how people in New York can really take me seriously. I still don't understand.
I want to get to this question, like, very explicitly in about 2 minutes. By the way, I'll just sort of say, for those of you who happen to be in New York in those days... which I was not on a regular basis, but back and forth a bit. In the days after 9/11, it was actually like such a fascinating time to be in New York because all of a sudden, the level of sort of kindness and acknowledgement was something that, like, if you're a New Yorker, you couldn't imagine. Meaning, I remember actually, this is a funny thing, one of the first Shabbatot of Kilat Hadar, what year was that? 2002? Beginning of 2002. So I was in New York. I was staying at my friend Ellie's apartment. That is Rabbi Ellie Confer. And I was carrying my bag. I come in to teach. And as we were getting off the one train, it was a crowded rush hour train, and I sort of accidentally ran over someone. This must have been like 2 months after 9/11. And this guy turns around to me and goes, "Hey, you just ran over my leg. But that's all right." And I was like, this is so interesting. Like, this is amazing. And then, I don't know if you remember this, like 3 months after 9/11, no, it was more than that, probably 4 or 5 months after 9/11, one of the best cartoons in the history of The New Yorker, there's two people sitting on the train, and one of them turns to the other and says, "Things are really getting back to normal. I hate everyone on this train." Right? And it's like, totally, there you go. They're like two poles of, like, you know, life after tragedy. And by the way, that's a whole other interesting discussion we could have about the ethos of humans in and after tragedy versus the ethos of humans, you know, on a regular basis. And there's a lot to sort of think about and talk about there. Shoshi.
I think, I'm not quite sure how to say this. I think a comment that's related to this conversation that Rachel kind of brought up is that, I mean, I really feel like if I am walking around and I feel like vulnerable and fragile and like a little nothing, that like I'm going to treat other people as if they're also feeling vulnerable and fragile. And maybe I'll just say vulnerable and fragile and not nothing, because I think when that boundary becomes like into some sort of self-loathing, that's kind of where the problem becomes, that I could be caught up in myself and not see other people as also being vulnerable and fragile. So I think that's one thing that, I'm sorry if that has kind of been said, but I wanted to say it outright. And then I also think that what's problematic for me about this conversation is that we're talking about the Sefer Panim Yafot, and we're not talking about the word Mekabel as much.
Next time, but okay.
Okay, and I think a lot of what it has to do, and this speaks to Shana's question, is that one time someone asked me for money, and I said, "I'm sorry, I don't have any change." And they said to me, like, "You're not sorry, don't say that." You know, they didn't care that person didn't care that I acknowledged him on the street, because all he wanted was money from me and was frustrated that I wasn't giving him what he wanted. But there are some people who want hope, and there are some people who want to be noticed. So I think, and this is like another level of sensitivity altogether that I don't think necessarily can, you know, we definitely, like, if smiling at people is hard to begin with, then like doing this is 10 times or 100 times harder than that. But like really to try to look at the person and to see where they are and to see what they need and to see how I can help in that way. And I want to find some way of reinterpreting the verse to put the emphasis on that person,
so,
which is kind of how these two ideas are connected.
So that's a, you know, it's interesting because the part three that we will look at in 2 weeks, right, is the transition from here to what it actually means to walk in God's ways and live compassionately, which is, in a way, what you're moving us towards, right? And the argument that I want to make, and this is just, you know, this is my working out of, you know, what I think the core ideas of Torah are that first, the notion of gratitude, right, and a consciousness of having received something that is an act of pure generosity orients me towards the desire to manifest generosity in the world. And second, that the notion of being created in the image of God mandates me to try and embody those values that God holds most dear, so that both gratitude, and by the way, and for that matter, the notion that everyone is Tzelem Elohim also means that I have no choice but to care about them. That means that both gratitude and Tzelem Elohim lead to the same spiritual and interpersonal conclusion of walking in God's ways, which is about loving kindness. We're getting there. I think what we're doing now is setting the table for really addressing Shana's question head on. Right, because we're not yet at the ultimate, and therefore, we're doing the theological foundation for the ultimate, and therefore, even though you can't set that table without, as we've seen, really thinking about that already. So here's the thing I want to just ask for a minute, and this requires really a willing suspension of whatever jadedness we might have, okay? I want to just ask you an experiment. I'm going to do this too. I want to ask people,